Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects on Radio at Firehouse.com. The hosts for this show are Tom Shand and Mike Wilbur. Mike and Tom, thank you for joining us. What's happening in the world of fire apparatus? And I know we've had a lot of news lately, so can you fill us in on what's been going on?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Pete. Today's rundown, as usual, Brother Mike's going to go over a couple of the recent incidents and, more importantly, accidents of what has transpired in the last 15, 20 days. We're then going to respond to a few questions of things that our listeners have sent in to us, and we'll get into those. And then we're going to talk a little bit about, with the tightening economy, what your department needs to do to kind of get their house in order to try to sell the concept that you need to get new apparatus for, in parentheses, your town fathers or the whoever kind of oversees the operations and the financial aspects of the department. So that's our topics for this month. Mike, what do we have on the newswire as to what's been going on lately?
Thank you, Brother Tom, and hello, everybody. We start out, Tom and I have a mutual friend, Jay Gordon Routley, who is lives up in Canada, and he sent Tom and I a picture of yet another waterway that has ejected off the front of a truck, a pinnable waterway that either wasn't pinned or the pin became dislodged somehow, some way, and the last section of the waterway, along with the nozzle assembly, ejected off the truck. Luckily, this time, nobody was hurt. If you recall, one of two line-of-duty deaths in and around aerial equipment this year occurred when Deputy Chief from Pennsylvania at a scene of a fire was struck in the chest by an errant waterway and was killed. And then doing some further investigation when I was at a major manufacturer earlier this month at the factory and asked the question, how many of these have you had? And this manufacturer has had at least three that have been reported with waterways, pinnable waterways that have either not been properly pinned or are not been pinned at all and have jettisoned off the side of the truck. And I think, Tom, this is one of those situations that if you've been around the fire service for a while, it's a lot like the runaway pumpers in the 50s, 60s, and 70s when people thought that they had the pumpers and pump gear, but they were still en route, and they would mysteriously start running down the road somewhere between 13 and 1700 RPM after the operator got to the pump panel and started to juice up the throttle a little bit. Have you had any experience with that?
You know, Mike, not personally of any ones that have been that I've been involved in or have investigated, but I agree with you. It's the kind of things that I would suspect that there's more instances of this happening out there than we kind of give credence to from a reportable standpoint, because I think a lot of these incidents happen, either later on in a fire ground situation or during training where maybe the waterway doesn't completely become disengaged from the ladder sections, but that something happens to the waterway that causes, you know, different components, many of these being quite expensive, by the way, to have to be repaired or replaced, and just people kind of chalk it up, unfortunately, to what, you know, they refer to in the airline industry as pilot error. So I don't have any personal experience with this, but I'm believing, like you, that this is, from in the world of safety, one of the more important things that firefighters need to kind of pay attention to. And one of those things, if you look from an option content standpoint, in the last, 10 to 15 years, this pinnable waterway and having a waterway, frankly, on an aerial device at all, went from being something that was like, air conditioning on units, Mike, in the early 90s. It was only occasionally requested, and the technology, very candidly, back in that area, was somewhat rudimentary compared to where we are today. Now just about everybody, or the majority of apparatus, right, wrong, or aerial apparatus, right, wrong, or indifferent, with the exception of some tiller units, you see people have these waterways on as a standard, and it kind of makes you wonder, because it's not something we use a lot, fortunately, on the fire ground, and it kind of makes you wonder, how often are they actually training with this, and what's the proficiency of the personnel to be able to use and deploy this thing and know safely how to operate that. And that, to me, maybe from a training perspective, is probably a lot more important than I think what the manufacturers are providing are safe components and will work if the people are properly trained and instructed, and then through the pass it on program, understand it as the older guys get older and in a volunteer department, don't start showing up. If your rig is 9 years old, 10 years old, and chances are that handful of people that maybe got that delivery engineer training in the first couple of days when the rig was delivered, I'll bet they're probably not very active, or maybe not even in the department anymore. So it makes you wonder, it's time about break out that operating manual and make sure that everybody in the department knows the safe way to go operate those components, Mike.
Yeah, Tom, and I think you brought up another good point. A real benefit to the fire service now that we are slowly embracing is the near-miss reporting system. Years ago, when pumpers would run away, it would be pretty much a localized event where the pumper would run away, and if you happened to be at the drill that night or whatever and nobody got hurt, maybe and maybe word leaked out to two or three departments around you. But now with the World Wide Web as it is and computers, chances are pretty good that if an event like that were to happen, there'd be pictures on the internet or a YouTube video before you got back to the station. And I think, like you said, it's imperative that people that have these near misses report them to the near miss reporting system. That's through iChief, so that we can keep track of these events. And what may seem like a localized problem to you, all of a sudden we start adding up the 50 states as they report in, and it becomes, a big operational problem that we either have to cure either through the manufacturing sector or through training. So you can go, all of our listeners, if you have problems like that, you can go to the near-miss reporting system so that as we age and we retire, those lessons that were learned on this equipment and in firefighting in general are archived so that others that follow us will be able to learn and not repeat the same mistakes. Moving on to the wrecks of the month, certainly one that's taken center stage in the past week or so, occurred in Provincetown at the tip of Cape Cod in Massachusetts, where a young 21-year-old firefighter who started out in the department as a junior at 13 years old was taking the truck out for a test drive with an unauthorized female passenger, lost control of the truck, and flipped it over. And anybody knowing anything about Cape Cod, out on the Cape, you realize that if you're at Provincetown, mutual aid can only come from one direction, and that is from coming east off of the mainland. And so you are surrounded by water, and so it takes help a long time to get out there. And it was the only ladder that they had, so certainly they're going to be missing the services of that piece. And having had the benefit of traveling out there this summer to do some classes out on the Cape for Brewster Fire and Orleans Fire, to go to Provincetown and just see the buildings that are so close together, They're all wood frame for the most part. The streets are very narrow, and of course, being right on the ocean, a big, you know, a working fire with an ocean gust, and you could lose half the town. So it's a very serious situation. And I spoke with somebody from there yesterday, from the Cape, and the fire chief there is absolutely devastated. The only thing that can be said for it is that neither the female passenger nor the firefighter driver were seriously hurt. It's just been recently learned that that driver has been charged with reckless driving and speeding, I believe, it's alleged. So that came out of the investigation by the police department. So our hearts and prayers go out to the firefighters in Provincetown, and particularly to the chief of department, who have to soldier on after this major event. Moving on, there was a tower ladder that crashed while responding in Connecticut earlier in the month. Of course, all by now have seen the pictures on the internet of the Hartsfield Atlanta Airport Oshkosh that was upside down. I believe that was in Oshkosh, wasn't it, Tom?
Yeah, it was, Mike. Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually the second picture of one of those rigs that I have upside down at that airport. They were raiding. What was interesting in the article that appeared, investigators were waiting to download information off the black box. And as been well documented by Tom and I over the last year or so, as of January 1st, 2009, all fire trucks are going to be equipped with black boxes that will be able to tell how fast you were going, how many brake applications were made prior to and during the event, how many were seated and belted, and a whole host of other information is going to be downloadable by authorities. The days of laying down 150 feet of skid marks and telling somebody that you were only doing 20 miles an hour are going to be gone forever. Again, since we talked last, a firefighter was injured at an accident scene when the fire apparatus ran over his foot. You can't make that up. In Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, responding apparatus, a ladder truck collided with a car. The man was, the civilian was taken away in critical condition, and he later died a couple of days later. And then in Chicago, a woman suffered traumatic injuries when the vehicle she was in collided with a Chicago fire apparatus. The engine was responding lights and sirens to a call of a working fire. And I think we should stop there and just say a minute that there have been any number of wrecks within the last couple months of apparatus responding to a working fire. And yes, do you want to get there? And yes, do you want to be first to? And yes, we don't have that as many fires as we once did, so everybody wants to go and help, and that's all well and good, but you don't do any good if you don't get there. And we have a responsibility to the public that pays for our equipment and in some cases pays our salary, that when they call, that we show up in a timely fashion and are able to do all the things that we need to be doing. And you can't do that if you wreck the rig. And what becomes worse then is that now you become part of the problem and not part of the solution. And particularly in rural jurisdictions, now we have two incidents that the incident commander must manage. One, the working fire, and then two, the accident with some of his people involved. And it just becomes a burden like no other. And we just don't want to go there and do that. To that end, in Hoopersville in Pennsylvania, they were responding to a brush fire when their tanker flipped over, And a couple of wrecks of late, I think, Tom, can give us some hope because the occupants were seated and belted in. In the Provincetown wreck, it was alleged that one of the two occupants were belted in. In Hooversville, both firefighters that were in the truck were belted in. And then it was also reported that in the St. Louis Quint videos where the two Quints collided and was put on YouTube, and probably everybody that has a computer in the fire service has that video on their computer now, those firefighters were all belted in. So it gives those of us hope, like you and I and Chief Goldfeder and Chief Salk and some of the other luminaries in this business that are out there pounding the pavement, trying to get people to do this a little bit better and a little bit safer. It gives us hope that we are actually making a difference. And so although the wrecks are tragic and traumatic, we've taken a lot of the tragedy out of them by having people that are belted in. Moving on, in New York State, a firefighter fell off an apparatus late last month and suffered a serious head injury. So with all the people that are belted in, we still have people that are not. And finally, on the fun side, it's funny, if you don't own this piece of equipment, I got pictures yesterday from Gillespie's Crane Service. Gillespie's Crane Service spent $4 million on a brand new Liebherr crane that was never used before. It was 9 days old, and some way, somehow, somebody screwed something up with the jack system, and there's about 8 pictures that were showed to me that showed this $4 million crane in a very grave state of disrepair. It actually was on top of what appears to be a parking garage, and when they set the thing up, the counterbalance weights, the truck actually flipped backwards and went through the top of the parking garage into the bottom of the parking garage. Amazingly, nobody was seriously hurt or killed, but certainly that information can transcend the fire service, where if you are going to set up aerial devices, that you need to be assured of what is underneath you so that you don't face the same kind of catastrophe. And what was interesting is just looking at that series of pictures, I was in Camden, Maine last weekend, and there was a parking garage, and it was actually painted a different color because it came right off the street, and the parking garage was underneath, and firefighters were well aware that that was a place that we were not going to set up any apparatus. And I guess it's just called knowing your district. And that kind of wraps up the news of the month. I'd like to move on now and give Brother Tom a question. And this was from one of our readers, Frank. And he writes, Tom, with respect to your anticipated 20-year life cycle for your apparatus, I would put heavy emphasis on service. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, we are in the process of writing specifications for 3 new engines to be bid in 2009. Some of the members of the committee have no problem with installing the Caterpillar C13 engine. I am a little more hesitant due to the fact after 2009, Caterpillar will not be making these engines anymore. We typically keep our apparatus 20 years. My concern is service and parts down the road. Do you feel this will be an issue? And thanking you in advance, Frank R. What do you think, Tom?
Well, first, Michael, I'd like to thank Frank for his question and for pondering this, you know, before they move forward. Here's a couple of thoughts. Just in general, a lot of people are of the impression that when they go purchase a piece of apparatus, it comes with, as a basis, the standard NFPA one-year, quote, bumper-to-bumper warranty that the manufacturer has to stand behind. But in essence, if you buy a fire truck, no matter who you buy it from, and if there's a an issue with the engine or the transmission, one of the driveline components, the manufacturer is going to coordinate the warranties, but you're not going to see the guy who built the body on your fire truck on a creeper in your fire station trying to diagnose and look at the engine if you have, you know, some type of engine throttle issue or it's running rough or seems to lack horsepower. He's not going to do that. You're going to be responsible for taking the rig or the vendor to take the rig out to the local repair facility, the authorized dealership, to repair that, you know, to look at and analyze either that Caterpillar, the Detroit, or the Cummins motor specifically. So to go to Frank's point, right, we've talked in previous podcasts that, as most of our listeners should be aware of by now, that in 2010, both Detroit Diesel and Caterpillar have made corporate decisions independent of one another that they're no longer going to supply their diesel power plants to the fire service, to the emergency services. So my recommendation to Frank would be to really, you know, to ponder a couple of things. Number one, what kind of engines or power plants do you have in the rest of your fleet at this point? If you already have a Caterpillar, that would tell me you probably have an established relationship with the local Caterpillar distributor, and they're aware that you have these, and they're going to give a little bit more emphasis to a fire truck, you know, as compared to if your same municipality brings in, for example, a dump truck or a refuse truck that's got a CATS, you know, C9 or C7 in it. You'd like to hope that your turnaround time on your fire truck is going to be a little bit better than a DPW vehicle. You know, the DPW folks aren't going to like that, but, you know, we'd like to think that we're going to be serviced, given a little bit of priority, since we normally don't have a whole lot of spare rigs. So if that's the case, to Frank's point, you probably, you know, the folks at that local Caterpillar distributor, they know you, you know them, and you've got a relationship there. If that's the case, then you would go down to them and inquire from their perspective. You know, if you're going to keep your fire truck 20 years, yeah, just about everybody in the fire service whose components you put on, and sometimes there's language in the specifications, Mike, that say you have to guarantee there's going to be parts availability for this for a minimum of 10 years. I think there's some language to that effect just about in every FDNY spec. Well, you start thinking about drive lines and axles and major components. You know, if that component is going to cease being offered to us as a service in 2010, and you're planning on keeping that rig until 2025 or 2030, now you really need to have some assurance that there's going to be parts availability for that engine. Good chance that engine in that format is probably not even going to, you know, certainly won't even be built anymore, because Lord knows what's coming down the pipe after the 2010 engine emission requirements from EPA. If your fleet has some other brand of engines in it and you don't have a relationship with the local Caterpillar distributor, my advice would be it's incumbent upon you to go down and go check them out, ask to have a meeting at some point of their convenience with their service manager, introduce yourselves, tell them what you're planning on doing, and find out what kind of service capabilities they have to take care of your apparatus in the future. Because after that one-year bumper-to-bumper warranty, Caterpillar, like most engine manufacturers, typically have a five-year 100% parts and labor warranty on the engine component. But then from year six to as long as you keep it, Mike, there is no warranty, and the responsibility to pay for those repairs falls back on the fire department. So you want to check into the company candidly the same way you would as an apparatus builder. You know, how long have these people been affiliated with Caterpillar? It's been a long term. Are they, you know, how close are they from a proximity standpoint to your community? You know, you can take this, for example, just if you're going to go buy a family car. You might like one brand of car, but if you've got to travel 30 miles each way every time you go to need to get the thing serviced, that might not be a great idea as compared to if there's somebody locally in your community or the next town over that can take care of you and going to fulfill not only the warranty requirements, but be there well beyond after the warranty, you know, wears off. So that would be our best advice here. If your fleet, you're already familiar with these folks, you know, you're maybe around in second base and headed towards third. If you have a fleet of engines that are Detroit or, you know, Cummins or some other, you know, maybe you don't even have that many diesel engines, you know, in your fleet, and you're getting involved with this, you know, you want to make sure that if you're going to put, as they say, all your eggs in one basket, that that basket's going to be well protected. So that would be, I think, our best advice there. Mike, what else you got for us this month?
Okay. I have questions for the apparatus architect. First, rear mount pumps are becoming more and more popular. What do you think about rear mount pumpers? And with economically spurred trend of smaller, more efficient apparatus, do you think that rear mount pumpers are a good choice for greater functionality for the dollar? Secondly, my department is trying to create a replacement schedule for apparatus to address our needs for the next 25 years. In your experience, what is a realistic yearly inflation rate for the cost of new fire apparatus, and how much should be budgeted for NFPA changes in the future? Holy cow.
Yeah, wow, there's a lot of good thoughts in there, and we appreciate that question in from Lance. And so let's take this, let's take the easy one first about rear mounts. Now, rear mount pumper apparatus were first developed and kind of came into prevalence a little bit during the late 80s and early 90s when a couple of apparatus builders who are unfortunately no longer around, Grumman and Salisbury, were two companies that kind of pioneered the rear mount concept, which is the way that rear fire pumps are mounted on apparatus in Europe and most other countries. So are they becoming more popular? Yeah, there's several inherent advantages that you've, everything being equal, you can package, since the fire pump itself takes up less physical space, it weighs less, that you can package more equipment per cubic foot or per length of the rig mic in a rear mount than you can typically with other these, some of these monster rescue engines that you see running around. Now, the fact where some people tend to lose it and say, well, I don't like a rear mount pumper. To me, the parallel, Mike, and you'll appreciate this, this is where us engine guys get to give you truck guys a big hug, all right? If your department traditionally ran, for example, side mount pump panel engines and rear mount ladder trucks, when it comes time to buy a pumper and you've got a group of guys who say, we think we ought to put the pump at the rear, that is labeled with about the same level of heresy that if you had a rear mount ladder and that's what the department had run since, you know, the last two or three rigs, and now some young buck comes in and goes, we need to buy a mid-mount power ladder. You know, you generally don't put a lot of smiles on the folks because they're not looking at the concept so much, in my opinion, as they are looking at the vehicle and just say, that's a change, I don't like change, we ain't doing it. Think got a little merit there, Mike?
Yeah, absolutely. We are certainly a service, Tom, that is 150 years or more of tradition, unimpeded by progress. And I, when I do classes, as you well know, just talk over and over again about those words that I think are ultimately going to be the net death knell of this service, and that's, we've always done it that way. And if you've looked at and reviewed some of the more tragic fires of late, Charleston in particular, and see some of the operations that occurred there, they were just mired in tradition rather than anything else. And it really at times stifles our growth, and we really become closed-minded about good ideas. Yet on the other hand, there are many vendors out there that woo the fire service, and with new products, and some of these more traditional places may take a chance on that new product and find out that it didn't work out all that well, and it kind of stifles any more trips into the land of the uncharted, and then you go back to that more traditional approach. So it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Yeah, exactly, Mike. I think if you look at, one of the things to look at is that to finish up on the rear mount question. When rear mounts first started to kind of take off, and it was done geographically, it was almost done by department, somebody decided to be, at one point I took a management class at Cornell, and they talked about companies that would be innovators, people that would not look at history, would not have to look at tradition and just say, we want to innovate, and they would jump out ahead and sometimes be 12 to 18 months ahead, Mike, of any other company in bringing new products to market or new concepts or new marketing schemes, and everybody would sit back and laugh at those guys. And in some cases, there were some tremendous successes. Every once in a while, they failed. Then the next group was referred to as the fast followers. Those would be the slightly more conservative companies that were always open to change, but folks that said they would recognize the proverbial, they'd recognize a good thing when it went by in the parade and say, hey, that's okay to go copy that. And they wouldn't be too far behind the innovative companies to bring out something that would complement or try to compete against what the innovative companies did. Then a third group would be the traditionalists, the folks that almost, and Mike, you've probably seen this in some of your classes as you speak your mind with respect to some safety aspects, there's always some barrel-chested gentleman sitting like in the third row from the back with his hands folded over his chest with a scowling look that basically says, son, I'm listening to you, but I'm not believing a word you say. And those companies would kind of poo-poo anything that either the innovative companies or the fast-following companies would come out with and say, we're not going there, all right? Well, if you look at rear-mount pumpers, it'll be interesting. You look at, as you're talking to some of the companies that you might entertain to build your truck, your engine rather, excuse me, ask them what their first rear-mount pumper was, just by date, from a chronology standpoint. And that'll give you a little bit of insight as to people that jumped on board very early on versus some of the companies that waited till the very end when they started losing business and said, geez, you know what, at our little ice cream stand, we always made chocolate and vanilla. And I looked at that guy across the street when he combined the two, and in my area, Western New York, they call it a twist. I don't know why. But, you know, I'm not buying. You don't combine chocolate and vanilla. You either buy chocolate or vanilla, but never the twain shall meet. And then when those people started realizing, I'm now losing business because that guy across the street figured out how to combine those two, like a rear mount, we had to incorporate a little technology and engineering, and it was a different, the pump still could have been made by Hale or Waters or Darley, but now it looks different and it's located different, no different than the fire departments, Mike. A lot of manufacturers were kind of slow to pick up on that trend, so it's not going to go away. On the other hand, I don't think you'll ever see it be 50% of the market here in the United States because we're too tradition-bound, as Brother Mike just said. So, to go to
Tom,
the second
I have one question. Now, what about the height of some of those units? That always, not being a pumper aficionado such as yourself, that was always quite troubling to have to work off this thing.
Well, with the rear mount, this is what happened with the overall design. With the rear-mount pumper, what most people opted to do from a body design standpoint, Mike, was say, okay, I now want full height, full depth compartments on both sides. So now we have like a rescue pumper style body. And the ground ladders either get enclosed in the right side, thrown up in the hose bed, every once in a while put on a hydraulic ladder rack. So what caused it to go so high on a rear-mount was that with the design of the body, it went from a T-type tank to a rectangular tank. And inherent in the rectangular tank, no different than if the pump's up in front, that with the rectangular tank, the water gets squeezed, the hose bed height goes up. So there are some rear mount designs that work pretty effectively. It just means you need to think about where you're deploying your attack lines. You know, now people are going to maybe having multiple bumper mounted lines or putting transverse lines either at the front of the body or enclosed within the body compartments. But you're right, good point. The average rear mount pumper, until you start paying attention, is that hose bed higher at the back than if you designed a FDNY style or DC style engine with an L-shaped tank and a low hose bed? Yeah, there's a big difference. And part of that's driven by the pump, but part of the bigger part of that is really driven by the design that you're looking to accomplish with everything else you want to carry. So very good point on that, and very astute coming from a ladder guy, but we appreciate that, right? To go to the gentleman's second question, this one's going to be a little tough, and we're going to have to put on our dancing shoes here and give you our best information, but it's going to be tough to nail this down. What kind of, realistic yearly inflation rate should we use? If we were operating in 2012, and we'd probably, with the impact of hindsight, probably be able to tell you a little bit better. Traditionally, as we've talked about, fire truck prices have been somewhat tied to the producer price index and have increased anywhere from 3.5%, 4%, 4.5%, in a bad year, 5%. We don't need to belabor the point of where our country is currently with respect to the impact of the stock market and inflation. This year, apparatus, no matter who you talk to, it would be safe to say that we've experienced a double-digit inflation factor for the calendar year of 2009, what or 2008. What does 09 and 10 look like? Well, part of that's going to be driven, if you go, again, look at the impact of the NFPA standards. Even if you take a round number of $10,000 on a $400,000 fire truck, right, there's a couple of percent right there just in the NFPA changes. It's too early to forecast what the 2010 engine costs are going to be. But suffice to say, that's going to add some more money. And it's, and unless you're one of these people that you see on one of the business channels, it's tough to forecast where our marketplace is going. But I think it would be suffice to say that in the past, the standard 4 to 4.5% is probably going to be undervalued, and you might be better off looking at, if you're trying to secure funds at least for the next year or so, to be figuring the fire trucks are probably going to go up on the order of 7 to 8% as a minimum per year. Can you take that number to the bank? That's just a forecast. You know, I kind of feel like that Kramer guy on CNBC. And just Mike and I are mad over what's happening to our industry and to the fire service, because the cost of apparatus is running almost at an all-time high, and that's happening at the same time that our economy, no matter how you perceive it, no matter what your political affiliations might be, it's pretty evident to see that our economy is not strong, and that has a direct impact over where the fire apparatus industry is going. So it's going to be almost impossible to project out more than 3 to 5 years in advance for the next couple of years to say what are costs going to be. But without a doubt, Mike, and to the gentleman who wrote the question, it's going to be more than it has historically occurred, and the sooner that you can procure a rig without messing up your replacement schedule, the better off you're going to be, because there's certainly going to be some significant cost avoidance over, what we've previously experienced. So with that, we're going to take a quick break, and the apparatus architects, Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, will be back in just a minute.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
Welcome back to the Apparatus Architects on Radio at firehouse.com. If you do have any questions for Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, please send an email to podcast@firehouse.com. Gentlemen, before we get into the second half of the show, it sounds like the last fellow who had a question was looking for some serious help in trying to get the plan, and I know you guys are involved in working with departments across the country to establish everything from design to the replacement plan. So can you maybe offer him some advice as far as the replacement plan for the rigs?
Yeah, Pete, here's one of the things that people sometimes, and Mike's in my experience, that when people solicit our advice to come in, it kind of starts out that there's one piece of apparatus in question, and it's almost like the fire department and whoever the overseeing layer is above the department, whether it's, you know, sometimes it's even internal within the department with their board of directors. More often than not, it's external, and there's a village board or a city council or a town board, the people that actually administer the funds and raise the taxes for the members, that it gets down to almost like they're in opposite corners of the ring. The firefighters are saying, we need to replace this rig. And here's the town fathers just saying, well, we need a better explanation why, or why do you need X amount of money? And I know, Mike, there's been a couple times where you've just even fielded phone calls from folks, and it's like they seem like they're just reaching out to anybody who they think can come in and like, you know, help pitch half an inning to get them out of this so they can go buy a single fire truck, but yet they're missing the whole point of from a fleet standpoint.
Right, absolutely, Tom. We've gone to different places and helped different departments, and what a lot of folks don't understand that do this is that the purchase that you make today can have a dramatic effect, you know, 6 or 8 years down the road. And if you recall a recent fleet evaluation and fire protection study we did, the department wanted a four-door enclosed pumper tanker, and the governing body chose to buy a two-door commercial cabin chassis pumper tanker, and they saved a bunch of money, and that served them well for 6 years until the district grew. They needed a second station, and they wanted to buy a rescue pumper and have it more rescue than pumper. But because of that poor choice of buying just a two-door cab pumper tanker, there wasn't sufficient room to ride a crew to deploy that to the second station that needed to be built. So now this rescue pumper has to be more of a pumper rescue based on the fact of the purchase that occurred 6 years earlier, where there just wasn't enough riding positions to run that pumper tanker as really a pumper, but rather it was just a fancy mobile water supply shuttle-type apparatus. And so purchases that are made and just doing fleet evaluations where one component of the fleet can have a dramatic impact on the overall fleet plan. And so it really behooves departments to go out and seek a trained set of unbiased third-party eyes to come in and give an unbiased view of your fleet and where you're headed. And many departments that we hear about and have interacted with have never had any kind of fleet replacement policy at all or any kind of plan. And with the cost of the apparatus escalating at such a high rate, to walk into a town or village board or the commissioners of a fire district or a city council and say, you know, pumper number one's rusting, you know, we need a new one next year, is you're going to probably be laughed out of City Hall because they're not going to be able to come up with that kind of money over the course of 1 year to placate the fire department. There needs to be a good long-range plan where not only the fire department, but the people that are going to fund this, again, whether it be a city council or a town board or fire commissioners, have a heads up so that they can properly plan financially for what, with the exception of a fire station itself, may become the largest capital expenditure that the department's going to undertake. And there's not too many garbage trucks or snow plows that are costing $1 million like an aerial tower is nowadays. And so we go hat in hand asking for a lot of money. And if the authority having jurisdiction funding this isn't on board with this plan and hasn't made provisions for that funding, you're probably going to get rejected, and not necessarily because you don't need the piece or that the other piece is in a state of disrepair, but rather that, that there was just too much of a surprise and not enough planning. So can't urge our listeners strongly enough, if you find yourself in this predicament, please go out and solicit somebody that knows something about this business and hire them on to come in and at the very least do a fleet evaluation and get yourself on a timed replacement schedule that you and the authority having jurisdiction and funding mechanisms can agree on so that you can properly fund and replace vehicles in a timely fashion. Your thoughts, Tom?
Mike, those are all good points. Things that a department, even if they feel that they want to try to initially tackle and put together a rough draft of a fleet replacement program, here are just some things, some considerations, that things that a department can do, whether they're going to try to rough something out themselves or bring somebody in from the outside. But these are little tidbits of background information and criteria that someone needs to be able to take a look at and then begin to analyze. The simplest thing to do is you look at the number of total units you have in your fleet and you plot them out from the oldest to the newest. That just gives you an idea of looking at a quick snapshot as to what the relative average age of apparatus in your fleet would be. Pretty common from Mike's and my experience to see, for example, if you got a volunteer or combination department, you're running two stations, you got four engines, a ladder truck, a rescue, and a couple of medic units and a whole bunch of some support units. Not uncommonly, you're going to find hopefully the average age of your engines are going to be a little bit newer than possibly the average age of your ladder truck because you got four engines but only one truck. So you're not buying that ladder truck as frequently as you are the engines. More importantly, the next thing you need to look at is what your cost of ownership of those units are. And cost of ownership is a summary of what the initial purchase price for the vehicle is. And then more importantly, on an annual basis, what are you spending for repairs and maintenance by each piece of apparatus? Not how many tires did you buy last year down at Sammy's Goodyear, but what rigs you put tires on? What rigs have you had to do pump repairs on? What units maybe might be an overweight rig, not uncommon from what Mike and I have seen, and you're burning through brakes on that one unit a lot more rapidly than another unit. You need to have a handle as to between your maintenance cost, your fuel and insurance cost, what your annual cost of ownership per rig is. If you're running a big fleet, an over-the-road trucking company, those folks can tell you how much the operating cost of the unit are per road mile when they're out hauling on the road. It's very surprising to Mike and I, the number of even good-sized fire departments, that when you get into the nuts and bolts of the maintenance side of the house, you say, well, how much did you expense last year to keep engine 2 on the road? And they're like, well, we'd have to go back and just pull all the 12 months' worth of bills and see if anything was attributed to engine 2 each at the end of each month when whomever paid the bills. And there's not a total or a summary or a log of that. That's some baseline information because in a lot of cases you can find out and sometimes really be surprised where a unit that's maybe 10 to 12 years old, that the perception is that thing is running this, you know, ragged and it's costing us an extreme amount of money. If you've got a rig that's out of warranty and maybe a 3 or 4 year old unit, that rig could maybe be costing you more money than the older rig, and you'd be surprised just by what the numbers show. So you need to plot out the ages of the units, what your cost of ownership on an annual basis between maintenance, fuel, insurance costs on these rigs are, to get an idea as to what it's actually costing you to keep that rig in your fleet. And in some departments where Mike and I have gone in where it just seemed like, you know, they had multiple stations and there was never an apparatus bay that didn't have a rig parked in it. And they were very proud that, you know, the proverbial, if you went by the station on a nice warm July afternoon and all the bay doors are up, there is something red, shiny, and chrome in every bay of the station. And then you start evaluating how often they use it, how many runs they make on that rig, how many times the unit is staffed, or that you have the staffing levels that you can even get the rig out on the street. You find out that in some jurisdictions, we frankly have more apparatus than we can staff. And when you look at the maintenance cost of this, this is one of the other things that Mike and I have encountered that and very prevalent today with the current financial conditions in many communities, that the annual maintenance budget for the department, whether it's your standalone maintenance budget or it's a sub-budget that goes under if you have your rigs go out to the local DPW to be done, or they have to go to outside vendors. It's one of the few areas that in a lot of fire departments, the politicians will look at that and go, well, geez, last year, $35,000 maintenance budget. You know, the DPW guys just took a 5% cut, we need to get 5% out of your maintenance budget. Well, you might be fooling yourself. Again, if you know how much it costs you to put the apparatus on the street and what your costs are, you know, you're now robbing Peter to pay Paul, because taking money out of that budget, if you've, and there was one example that Mike and I can cite more recently of a good size, you know, county fire department operation that is millions of dollars in the hole, that they went and burned through their entire maintenance budget somewhere between month 9 and month 10 of their fiscal year. Yet when the new budget rolled out, the maintenance division took another hit and they lost more money out of that budget. Well, you're kidding yourself. If you couldn't make your budget last 10 months by lowering it, and you're not going to supplement or buy any new apparatus, or you're not getting rid of anything, where in God's name is that money going to come from to keep, as they call it, the fleet on the street? You know, we should have those numbers at the ready so we can defend ourselves even when we're put in that position to have to defend our maintenance costs on our apparatus. And as Mike said, if you've got a $800,000 to $900,000 aerial device, a rear mount tower, for example, all right, that in a smaller department you were fortunate enough to buy it 5 or 6 years ago, doesn't run all that much. That doesn't mean that the maintenance cost on that unit still can't eat up a good part of your budget each year. And if you don't have the money to expend on that, you've now, like, you know, bought the flagship for your fleet, but you're not in a position to take care of it from a preventative maintenance standpoint because you don't have the funds to do it. Now, at that point, you don't have to worry about buying a new fire truck. You're not doing a good job taking care of the stuff that you already own. And Michael and I have seen numerous examples of that in a lot of different locales. There are departments that are running on what would appear to be a shoestring budget, but they do a great job in keeping the apparatus operational, keep it properly maintained in accordance with both the manufacturers and the NFPA standards. They have established out-of-service criteria, and it costs you a good amount of money to do that. But just because you buy a brand-new fire truck doesn't necessarily mean that your maintenance budget is going to go down, or that you could take a 10 or 15% hit in there. So if you establish those things, you're starting to get put together the roadmap for looking and say, okay, now you can make some intelligent decisions over from an annual cost of ownership perspective. If your department runs a lot and you're in a major urban department, you've probably already got a maintenance software system. It calculates that. It'll tell you what the cost per mile is. And in some departments that Michael and I have worked with, those people can tell you by brand of apparatus what is the lesser cost in their operating environment, what the lowest cost of operating cost per mile or per run is based on certain components or combination of components, and whose manufacturer's nameplate's on the front. Now, you think about it, how cool would that be to know if you're having a, you know, reasonably healthy discussion over some guys want to buy this brand of apparatus and other guys want to buy this, and you can't even come to a decision on that. How about we objectively look at what's it cost us for the current units, if you have those rigs in the fleet, to keep those things up and operational? I mean, dollars and cents don't lie to our listeners. It's an unemotional thing. It may be very emotional to buy the rig and have to think that, geez, I'm kind of losing that, you know, I'm not getting the components, or we're not going to buy brand whatever, so now I'm aggravated and I'm going to be off the apparatus committee. you need to have this unemotional, statistical data to be able to back up so you can make intelligent decisions rather than emotional decisions. And then, as the plan begins to formulate and comes together, many times with the assistance of some outside folks that are unaffiliated with your department or the municipality, then you can use that criteria to make an unemotional mission to go talk to your town fathers or whomever administers the funds to make them understand, here's what's going on and why. More recently, Mike, just within the last 2 weeks, a local large newspaper in western New York, it was front page on a Sunday morning when just about everybody buys a newspaper, chastising local volunteer fire departments. And the theme of the newspaper article was they were chastising departments that had money put away in reserves to use for, in the newspaper's mindset, it was a rainy day fund, right? Well, unfortunately, while a little bit of what they what their gist of the story was had some a little bit of meat behind it, they were unfortunately comparing, in the state of New York, fire districts, a department that's administered by commissioners, where the commissioners can legally establish a tax levy where the taxes are then collected by the town. They were comparing that type of organization to the same thing as a fire protection district, where the fire department is incorporated. The department itself can't levy taxes. They contract with the community, and when they're going to go build a new fire station or buy a new fire truck, their option is, get a loan, get a mortgage, or pay partially cash on the barrelhead like you would a car. If you're going to buy a $20,000 car, what are the car payments if you have to go get, particularly in today's economy, a car loan for the whole $20,000, as compared to saying, I've saved $8,000, I'm going to trade in my old clunker and get $2,000, so now I only need a loan for $10,000 because I've already got $10,000 in equity. And that's the part that this newspaper, Mike, missed. But they were chastising the fire departments for having, in some cases, it would be known as a capital reserve account. Well, that amount is what you need if you're going to go buy a fire truck. You probably don't want to go out and bond for the entire amount or get a loan for the entire cost of the fire truck. You'd like to be able to pay some cash down or maybe entirely. But as we've talked previously, with the average Class A custom pumper being well over $400,000 if it's got a big block motor, and many of them approaching five. And I've seen some bid results lately, Mike, that just make what little gray hair I have turn white, that you see people, pushing $600,000 for a pumper. That's pretty expensive motor vehicle in most municipalities' fleets. If you don't have a plan, if you don't have unemotional, rational facts and figures that you can establish a discourse, if you look at school districts' votes, budgets being voted down, the days of us just being nice guys and saying, in a volunteer organization, hey, they're volunteer, just, give them what they want. Those days, if they still exist anywhere in America, somebody please let us know, because they're disappearing rapidly.
Yeah, you certainly have that right, Tom. The open checkbook days are gone forever, and it just seems like the days of buying a good custom pumper for less than $400,000 are gone forever as well.
In future podcasts, we'll have some more discussion over, some of the finer details of what it takes to put a whole program together. But suffice to say that, it needs to be more fact and rationally based rather than emotional. And in the fire service, as we've talked about, between a combination of tradition and some emotion, it's very difficult sometimes to check those things. And as they say sometimes in a training class where you've got some senior members and you're covering a rather mundane topic, in their mind they'd be like, oh my God, why do I have to sit through this 90-minute presentation, and then we're going to go out and go do it in the drill yard for an hour. I've already done this for 22 years. Why do I need to do it in for the 23rd year? We frankly need to check our egos at the door, as they the old saying goes, and talk from a rational and a pragmatic perspective, and not from this emotional, Mike and I are on opposite sides of the table, and if I don't get what I want, I'm picking up my marbles, and I'm going, you know, I'm taking my hose and nozzles, and I'm going home, you know. Those, you know, that type of reaction is not going to cut it in today's political climate, much less today's political and economic climate. So, Mike, wrapping up here, any final thoughts on the thoughts and topics of the day?
Yeah, I think, Tom, that we have to prepare ourselves for a lot of fiscal conservatism. I think in the days and weeks ahead, times are going to be truly tough. But on the other hand, people are still going to need to go out and purchase fire apparatus. I don't think there's any denying that to some point. But I think as people lose their jobs, as taxpayers, and there's kind of a reinspection of how we conduct business, we're going to have to find new and exciting ways on how to fund projects and either rehab, use the apparatus, or to be able to purchase new. Best thing we can do is hope that next year the economy turns around a little bit and we can come back up to speed. And you, Tom?
Well, very good. Mike, I'd like to thank all our listeners for their responsiveness and for listening in to the Apparatus Architects on the podcast, and encourage anyone, if you have any other questions covering any area of apparatus design, maintenance, or from a fleet perspective, please send them in. So until the next time, this is Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects, wishing everybody, particularly at this time, to stay safe during the holiday season.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.